There was loads on the radio today, from the real life story behind a novel on stalking and the price of sending your parcels abroad, to the impact of Brexit on the cost of your new three-piece suite. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Yeah, I mean, other people are talking about going to the jungle, I'm a celebrity, Strictly Come Dancing. She's well known across these islands. And as I say, you know, she is relatively young. She's got a lot of energy. She's a lot more to give. I don't think we've heard the last of Arlene Foster.
Brexit, absolute, 100% nightmare. Nobody expected it to be as bad as it has become.
It's not a uniquely Irish situation. No. There are famines still all over the world, and what that means to be, you know, hungry and displaced.
And we'll start with the live line. John Mallon called Joe with some good news and to thank the emergency services that saved his son Jack's life.
John Mallon. John, good afternoon, sir.
Joe, good afternoon. How are you?
And how are you? People will recognise your voice, and indeed, if they have a TV, they recognise your that incredible footage of you that incredible afternoon when Rachel rode home in Aintree on Manila Times, which is a horse you discovered years and years ago, so to speak, which is your incredible skill, as well as running the Hotel Manila down there in Clonmel. What happened, John? And I know you want to thank certain people. What happened?
Joe, I want to thank the emergency service in South Tipperary, Garda John Fogarty and Stephen Robinson and Garda Miles, and helicopters 711, Carol Kennedy, Nigel Wall and Paddy Pike in the fire service and the ambulance service and the Carrick and Shore River Rescue. They were unbelievable, Joe. My son, Jack, he slipped into the river last Thursday evening, a bad evening.
Wow.
And he was seen by, Jack has special needs, he was seen by a woman on the other side of the river, Fiona O'Dwyer, and she rang 999. And the operation that swung in, the people, it was unbelievable. And they saved my son's life.
And it's the shore, isn't it, that goes through Clonmel?
Sure, yeah.
And when it's in full spate, that is a big, big river.
Oh, yeah.
That is a big, powerful river.
It was a lot of flood. It had risen 5 or 6 feet in a few days. You know,
so what time did this happen?
It happened about 7 o'clock on last Thursday evening.
Okay, dusk. So Jack slipped in. Not that it would help when you get the shock of a fast-flowing river and cold. Can Jack swim?
He can, yeah. No, he has done an awful lot of swimming, and during the pandemic, he swam with his cousins every day. And a man that does swimming lessons with Johnny Guidra, he's a saint. He's swimming with Jack for 10 years
every week,
and he's learned him how to swim in his back, and Jack stayed in his back. The people could see them from the blue way, and they couldn't believe how comfortable he was in his space, and how he didn't panic, and how he survived. You know.
Jack flipped onto his back to stay afloat.
Well, that's
some thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
When everyone else would be panicking. Okay, so he's now in the river, and a passerby spots him from the far side.
Well done,
Fiona. She dials 999.
999, yeah.
And what happened next? Who arrived first?
And the guard of Fogarty and guard of Robinson and guard of Miles arrived first.
Okay.
I didn't know he was in it for 20 minutes after it happened, maybe half hour, when I saw the commotion.
And is Jack now moving down the river, John?
He's moving down the river, yeah. He held onto some bushes and he got let go again, and he went about a mile and a half in the river.
That's incredible.
And they were unbelievable, like they were so confident.
So the Gardaí, the Gardaí wouldn't have the gear or the equipment, but they did manage to see him or get near to him, did they?
They had eyes on him. They got eyes on him and they could see him. And the Gardaí too, they mightn't have the equipment, but two Gardaí passed me and they went in through a ditch like a Labrador taking a duck out of a pond.
Wow.
Just splash, you know. And they couldn't get to him. Garda Robinson and Garda Fogarty. And then the firemen, Nigel Wall and Paddy Pike, swam across the river. Like the fire service were so lucky. They're unbelievable men. They risk their lives every day, and these are part-time firemen that are savagely trained.
Just to explain to people, they're retained for, they're not in the station all the time. So
no, Nigel will be selling batteries in the car accessory shop, and he gets the call.
And there's men and women involved all over the country. Retired firefighters, an incredible job to do.
And Joe brought in Carol Kennedy to the story.
I want to go to Carol Kennedy, who's Assistant Chief Fire Officer in Tipperary Fire Service. Carol, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
And congratulations, Chief, and to you and all your colleagues on what an incredible job. You arrived on the scene as well, Carol.
Yes, we arrived on the scene, I suppose, Clonmel and Swiftwater Rescue Team and our life jacket competent users came.
A Swiftwater Rescue Team?
We do.
Well done.
Well, we're lucky we have the support of our Chief Executive here and a very proactive Chief Fire Officer, Dave Carl, which means we can put a lot of resources into water rescue. So having the River Shore, we deemed it necessary then to have a Swiftwater Rescue response. So that's set up in Clonmel. So it was from Clonmel Fire Station that they were mobilised.
Okay. And where are you based, Carol? Where did you
come
from?
I'm in Clonmel as well. I'm also in Clonmel, yeah.
So you sped across. Who's in the Swiftwater Rescue group?
We have a number of fire officers in there, our firefighters in it. So I suppose we had three swimmers in the water that day. So we had Stephen O'Donnell, Paddy Pike and Nigel Wall all went into the water that day. But they were backed up by everyone on the bank.
Of course,
then it's very much, you know, Joe, it's very much a team effort from station officers, firefighters, everyone.
And it's a disciplined team effort as well. Everyone has to know what they're doing.
It absolutely is. And I suppose we were lucky just 2 weeks before that we had both myself and Paddy Pike, the firefighter, are instructors in Swiftwater Rescue. So we had just recerted the team 2 weeks beforehand. So it is a very disciplined techniques and rescues that they have to learn. But we're great to have that resource in Clonmel. And if we could just encourage people, if someone does fall into the river, that chain of survival, that initial phone call makes the world of difference getting that time in. So to just ring that 999 and ask for your fire service and the Coast Guard is really going a long way to helping that person in the water.
And I know it's a hard thing for people to hear, but do not go in after someone in the water unless you're an extraordinarily competent and I've done training in water rescue.
And that's treacherous. So we have all the equipment, we have all the bells and whistles with us, you know, so, and we have backup all the way down the river. I don't know if John saw it on the night, but like we'll have our life jacket competent users with throw bags and we have a backup plan for every kind of scenario. So and we're fully trained to do that. And it takes a long time. Clonmel have had a Swiftwater Rescue Team now for nearly 10 years. And we're at the level we are because of constant training and practice.
And Carol, you arrive. Are the three fire personnel that got in, are they suited and booted in that rescue gear? Yeah,
they are suited and booted in the station, and get into the Swiftwater Rescue van.
So they're ready the minute they arrive to get in to where once they assess.
The ground, they're ready to go. Yeah.
And tell us about the river. Sure, we used to hear so often about Clonmel flooding and Carrick flooding and. So it's a big, big river, especially in spate, when it's in full spate. Is it a dangerous river?
There are spots that are definitely dangerous. We have a weir in Clonmel. I suppose weirs would be traditionally black zones, really, on rivers. And I suppose the fact that we have a Swiftwater Rescue Technician team will really indicate how dangerous the river is. We wouldn't have that response unless it was necessary. But as you say, Joe, in full flow, that river is very, very dangerous. It's a lot of technical rescues going on there. So, I mean, it's certainly something we're very proud to have in Tipperary Fire Service. And again, like our Chief Fire Officer is very proactive in that kind of way.
And Carol, you are... I know your Chief Dave is proactive and you're very proactive, but you're also very modest. Am I right saying, somebody is texting saying, you are one of the most qualified Swiftwater Rescue instructors in the country, and as the only female officer in the country trained to a level that you are an instructor.
Is it true or false?
Well,
I'm the only female Swiftwater Rescue Technician instructor, but sure. That's not to say there won't be more behind me.
There will be more.
Absolutely.
And it was back to John Mallon and his son, Jack.
Yeah, he was in hospital, Joe, for a couple of days with hypothermia, but he's very good. He's a strong little man. He was back to school, high school on Monday.
Wow.
And he's on holidays now, so he's great, thank God. And I'm proud as I can be. We're so proud of him and so thankful.
And were you able to find out what happened, John? Because the Hotel Manila is near the river.
Yeah, we're on the river. He slipped. Yeah, okay. He was with me, and he was going swimming with his cousins in the pool, and he went around the back, and he walked around the garden. I thought he was gone in, and there's a gateway where there'd be a boat, and he walked down to the gateway of the boat. He walked down the steps, and it was very mucky.
Okay.
And I think he got his feet stuck in the muck, and maybe he fell backwards, and it just took him out.
Awesome.
Just a split second.
Carol.
So to give a bit of reference there as well, it has been raining a lot in Clonmel over the past couple of days, and really, I mean, it just shows anybody can fall in at any time, and we just all really need to be careful, especially with, you know, ourselves around riverbanks, because they are so slippy and trips and falls can happen at any time.
And have you been able, John, to explain to Jack just to be extra careful, or
we don't. Jack especially needs. We don't want to make it glorified with it.
But he
understands. He understands the danger of the situation. Now he said to me, "Put a chain on the gate." You know,
he said to you, "Well done."
Put
well
a chain
done.
On the gate. Yeah.
John Mallon on the live line with Joe Duffy. And it was the 28th of May. So what does that mean?
On both the radio and TV teams this morning, very kindly, were very welcoming to me today, because today I'm 48 years old, and this is a very nice way for me to say thank you and goodbye to the Late Late Show for this season, and thank you and goodbye to the radio show for a couple of weeks, because I'm gone fishing, essentially, and mountain climbing, don't forget that. So they had lovely gifts of cakes and candles and balloons and all the fuss that I pretend I don't like but secretly love, and it's really touching, actually really kind. So thank you for that.
Oh, happy birthday, Ryan. And listeners wanted to encourage Ryan's birthday mission to climb Carrin Toohill.
On your trek to Kerry, try to do the climb at the end of your 2 weeks in case of injury. I'll climb when I want to climb. That's what I'm going to do. God damn it, I'm 48 years old now and I know my own mind. I have a dreadful fear of heights, says Mary, by email, but always wanted to climb Carrin Toohill. Mainly because I had my very adventurous family of four, I was the only one who hadn't. And a few years back, I read the book Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. So I decided I'm going to do it for my 50th. 2 years later, without lockdown as an excuse, I rounded up the Fab Four. Wednesday of this week, we took off from Limerick, got breakfast rolls and a few bottles of water in Newcastle West on the way. We were blessed with glorious weather. We arrived at Cronin's Yard, 11:30, took off along a most beautiful track, then up the infamous Devil's Ladder, which was tough but manageable. I would be fairly active, average fitness level. When we got to the top, I can't explain the feeling of excitement and achievement and emotion and joy. The views were out of this world. The people we met along the way and at the top were amazing, friendly smiles, words of encouragement. It was great. For me, the hardest part, says Mary, was the descent. Going up, I kept telling myself, don't look down. But going down, you kind of have to. So we came down Brother O'Shea's gully. Seriously, there was one or two occasions that the fear was getting the better of me. The only feeling greater than reaching the top of Carrin Toohill was reaching the bottom. Yeah. The heavenly gates for me were the ones leaving Cronin's Yard. So yesterday, I couldn't move my legs. I was stiff as a poker to go upstairs. I got flashbacks. Very good. The whole experience was the biggest mix of emotions I ever felt in one day. Anticipation, excitement, fear, joy, fun, pain, peace, beauty, people. Am I glad I did it? 100%. An amazing adventure. Would I do it again? God, no. I don't know how to feel about any of that. But good. Thank you for that. And I'm definitely doing it. I am 100% committed to doing it. And it's going to help. So, as I was saying to Oliver this morning by text, you may need to pack some extra clothes because I might not be back in 2 weeks. It could all go pear-shaped. In that case, in case that happens, but it's been lovely. Thank you. But thank you for your company and I've enjoyed every minute.
And Tim had some advice too.
Tim from Cork was on to say, I would not recommend you climb the mountain via O'Shea's Gully and not to descend via the Heavenly Gates, not as a first timer. You should go up via the Hydra Road and descend via the zigzags. The first two are very steep and very demanding. There's no easy route, but you should not do the first two to start. If you have even the slightest fear of heights, you'll know what I mean if you do them. It's pretty menacing email, isn't it? I mean, I know it's advice, but it's kind of scared the bejays out of me now. Thanks for that, Tom. I will go with adults, though. I mean, I'm not going to just hoof it up there in my leather shoes going, hello, I'm looking for the pub. No. We won't do that.
From the Ryan to Brady Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, how the personal experience of being stalked inspired the new novel called The Killing Kind. Author Jane Casey was telling Claire about the central character, barrister Ingrid Lewis.
I mean, I'm always really interested by women having to do jobs in a slightly different way from men. And she has to go through a very different set of difficulties to any of her male colleagues in that, in doing her job, she attracts the attention of a stalker who, you know, I think lots of women have this experience of just wanting to get on with their life and somehow just finding themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time and attracting unwanted attention. So she's quite a tough character, but she's been through an awful lot.
Yeah, I found that interesting, your take on the impact of the stalker on Ingrid's life. So it's quite stressful to read how she has to think about how she goes home from work, for example.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, everybody who writes books takes things that have happened in their own lives and kind of amplifies that. I had experience when I was 18 of attracting some unwanted attention from a fellow student at university. So even though he was a very kind of benign person, and I don't think he had any malice at his heart, which is not the case with John Webster in The Killing Kind, he certainly put me through a lot of very difficult and uncomfortable situations. And I think writing The Killing Kind was really cathartic for me in just sort of saying, look, this is what it feels like to be targeted. This is what it's like to be singled out and to have no way of stopping someone from being obsessed with you.
So regardless of the fact that this person in your life was benign in their intention, it's about the impact.
Absolutely. Like, I think, you know, he was a very vulnerable person in some ways and very intelligent. But I found it was impossible to get him to listen to me. So it felt as if I was just not making any noise when I spoke. And that's something that Ingrid also feels, you know, she has no way out. Now, for me, it was things like being given unwanted gifts and being followed around Oxford, which is where I was studying. So, you know, trying to second guess where he would be and where I would be safe to go. And for Ingrid, it's very much more, I think someone is trying to kill me. And if I choose the wrong path, then this actually might be the end of my life.
Mm. So, it doesn't matter, you know, though. It doesn't matter because it's about how it makes you feel and about how it forces you to change how you live your life.
It does. And I remember there was one night, I remember I've always been a night owl, and I was living in college accommodation on site. And it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. There was no one around. And I heard footsteps in the corridor outside my room. And I knew immediately it was him. And he knocked on my door and I didn't answer it. And I was standing there in the middle of the room. I remember this so clearly, waiting to see what would happen and not daring to make a sound. And eventually, I mean, it felt like a lifetime, but he put a note under the door and I heard him go away. And I think that was the thing that really terrified me about it, was the fact that I knew that the door wasn't locked, but he didn't know that.
And you felt you couldn't move towards the door to lock it?
No, I couldn't. I mean, I just didn't dare. So, I mean, it's that kind of feeling. If I'd answered the door, I'm sure he would have been perfectly pleasant. But I remember so clearly standing there and thinking, I have no way of calling for help. There's nothing I can do. I'm completely trapped here.
And Claire asked Jane if she reported the stalking to anyone.
I didn't, because, you know, at the time there was no conversation about stalking. This is like, we're going back 26 years ago, and there was no sort of official way of handling any of these things. It was something that was viewed as a joke by a lot of people. Mm. I remember, you know, it was very well known that he was obsessed and that he would always kind of follow me around and people would make jokes about it. I just looked up the University of Oxford and they published a policy on stalking and harassment in 2014. So we're kind of like, that's a long gap between when it was happening to me and when it started to be taken seriously. So there was kind of just nowhere to go.
Yeah, and just going back then to Ingrid Lewis in the book, she has a very complex relationship. I don't want to give too much away here now, but she's a very complex relationship with John Webster, her stalker. He uses really dodgy means to get information, but Ingrid can extract some good or some usefulness out of what he does.
That's right. I mean, I didn't want to write kind of your standard stalking novel because, you know, you always want to take things a step further. So the beginning of the novel, Ingrid has been stalked. That's kind of in her past. And then she becomes aware that someone is trying to kill her. And she turns to John Webster because I think her feeling is either he will help her or she will get enough on him to be able to lock him up forever. So she's sort of walking a tightrope between trusting him and not trusting him. And that really is at the heart of the book.
Can we talk about the year you've just had during the pandemic? You live in London. Normally you'd be back over and back to Dublin a lot, but your mother was very ill and died very sadly at Christmas time. Now, anyone who's listening to this, who's been through that experience during the pandemic, will understand just how difficult that is.
I mean, it was really, you know, I know so many people have had this experience. I think we'll all look back on sort of 2020 as the year that didn't happen, but actually life goes on and people do fall ill. And you know, I feel incredibly sad about the fact that I only saw her once during the last year of her life. I feel like we were really robbed of some time that we could have had and some conversations that we could have had. But she was taken ill just before Christmas. And my sister and I had that classic experience of flying back into Dublin, knowing that we were going straight from the airport to the hospital. And, you know, it's the flight that nobody wants to take. Mm-hmm. Anyone who lives abroad will have feared this, like, their whole time that they're abroad. And we went straight to the hospital to the Mater. And, you know, we arrived in from London at a time when everybody was starting to be very worried about the Kent variant and about how COVID was spreading in the UK. And so we felt as if we were putting people at risk just by being there. And it was a very complicated and sad set of experiences because of that. You know, my mother was in intensive care for about a week and we were coming in every day and putting on PPE and going in to be with her. And we were lucky that we were able to go in and be with her and that we had, you know, the nurses were incredibly kind and incredibly supportive of us. And that was a massive comfort to us.
I was talking to somebody coincidentally about this last night, and in their own situation, they felt angry with themselves for listening and adhering to the restrictions because of all of the conversations that they missed and the special time that they feel, as you say, was robbed from them. I mean, how have you dealt in the aftermath with all of that?
I mean, I'm trying not to be bitter about it, but I think, you know, we've just had this week Dominic Cummings talking about the shortcomings in the British response to COVID. And, you know, they didn't handle it well. And I think people in Ireland really suffered as a result of that. And it's very hard not to be angry about that. I mean, on my own sort of, I feel for myself, I did the best that I could and I tried to be as responsible as I could. And I think everyone was just trying to do the right thing, or the very great majority of us was trying to do the right thing. So that's all you can do.
Jane Casey, her new book is called The Killing Kind. From Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, artist Paula Stokes was telling Ryan about her new work being displayed at the National Famine Museum in County Roscommon this week.
Well, I'm down here in Roscommon at Strokestown Parkhouse, where for the past week I've been setting up my exhibition, 1845 Memento Mori. And Memento Mori is a famine memorial made from thousands of hand-blown glass potatoes. And this is the kickoff event in Ireland. It's a touring exhibition. And I've been working on this project for about the last 15 years. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Really? And are there, when you say thousands, are there 1,845 glass potatoes?
That's correct. That was that there are at least that. I actually also made some extras just in case any got broken.
Broken along the way. I have to ask you about the genesis of this idea. You're working on it for 15 years, and I'm looking at, I mean, they just look like, if you can imagine, a massive pile of potatoes on top of each other and just replace the actual spud with a glass version of them. That's what we're dealing here. But where did this come from?
Well, you know, it started about 15 years ago, and I've been living in Seattle, Washington, since 1993. I emigrated there on a green card and never came back. I do come back regularly to visit my family. But at that point, I was living in America almost as long as I'd lived in Ireland. So I was kind of at this threshold where, you know, that's kind of a major time in a person's life when I'm kind of reflecting on where I've come from and where I'm going. So it's at this threshold, and I wanted to create something. It was a very personal act, actually, just to create something that connected me with Ireland and my heritage and culture as an immigrant living abroad. And for me, that was actually the simple, humble potato. And I'm an artist who works primarily in glass. So potato, of course, is iconic with Ireland. And I love potatoes in all shapes and forms. Mm. And so that was it. That was the beginning. So I made a handful of them. And I set them aside, not really knowing what to do with them. And fast forward about 3 years ago, there was a kind of confluence of different events that inspired me to actually go for it and make this memorial. It was a huge undertaking, and it is a huge undertaking in terms of the physicality of making the work and producing it, shipping it, and finding venues to show it. And also, of course, the topic being the famine is a very deeply serious one, and I needed to make sure I got it right.
And yeah, you have got it right. It's very stark, isn't it, when you see it in all its glory?
It is. You know, I didn't try to recreate an imitation of a potato. I made the glass potatoes out of clear glass, and then when they're cold, I sandblasted the surface, so they have kind of a frosted quality, so they look like ghosts. Very kind of the absence of colour is intentional, and in doing that, then it just creates this kind of a wraith-like effect.
It would have been very comfortable in some ways in the coming home, that wonderful exhibition, the Art and the Great Hunger exhibition a few years ago.
Absolutely. I saw that show at Dublin Castle when it premiered in Dublin.
Yes.
I happened to be in Ireland, and I went to see it, and it blew me away.
Yeah.
And I think that was definitely a very major point where I realised that there was a place for my work and that I could show it in that context. And that was hugely inspirational.
Great. I would agree with you. I felt that exhibition really stayed with me and has to this day. It was really powerful and showed the power of art on the soul.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do you think it is that the famine is so meaningful to yourself, myself, to people who seem to have let it get under the skin? What is it about the famine story?
Well, it's inherent. It's so much part of our history, our shared history as Irish people. And then when you think about the emigration experience of the millions of people, who died, but also who emigrated all over the world, and this massive diaspora. And, you know, I think something like 70 million people claim Irish heritage, you know, across the world, which from a tiny island floating around in the Atlantic Ocean, it's a pretty amazing an amazing thing. And I think it's really shaped me just in terms of thinking back. My circumstances of immigration obviously are very, very different from those of the people who went during the famine. But there is that sense of, you know, being far away from home, but also deeply connected to it. And I think also you can look at it in contemporary times and what famine means. It's not a uniquely Irish situation.
No.
There are famines still all over the world, and what that means to be, you know, hungry and displaced. And I think that's a very important thing. And for me, with the work, it's really about, you know, presenting the work and remembering, you know, where we came from, but also to perhaps evoke a sense of compassion to others who may be in the same boat as we were way back then in terms of, you know, global migration.
And Ryan asked Paula about that sense of compassion Irish people feel about other people's struggles.
When you watch the news, big news reports about, let's say, Ethiopia once upon a time, or Somalia latterly, or you might see something in the Middle East and you see what can only be described as oppression or degradation from at a national level. I feel because of the famine and the troubles, you feel much more connected to a news story because of our own story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I've read that Irish people, you know, I grew up in Ireland in the 80s, and obviously the famines in Africa were very much in the news at the time. But the generosity of the Irish, even though we might not have been a very wealthy country at the time, but per capita, the philanthropy and the generosity of just the average Irish person with the troker boxes, giving money, and also being so aware and connected with that, I think that it makes us who we are. And I think Irish people are very special and very kind and very generous.
Well, that was writ large. I mean, sorry to bring it back, but with €20 million donated to the Late Show viewers in the last 18 months, it comes from exactly the place you've just described. I think we have this part of our psyche that says, okay, I feel the need to help.
Yeah, and it's in the DNA. And when you think about what just happened in Arizona with COVID, with the Navajo people and the huge outpouring of support, and a lot of it was actually out of the Irish community, Irish-American community in Arizona. And then that goes back, of course, to the
Choctaw.
Is, you know, just gives me shivers to think that these people who are on the Trail of Tears in the 1800s, and they were being displaced, and they sent this gift back to Ireland. I mean, it's just... Yeah. Fantastic.
I know, and that beautiful sculpture there in Cork with the feathers. Which I must say, well, on the by, thank you to Pat Green, who sent me a beautiful photograph of that in a frame, because I find that, you say goosebumps, I agree with you, I find that story very moving every time I see or hear about it. I'm looking forward to seeing your exhibition in Strokestown, because that's a great old museum you're in there, isn't it?
It is, you know, so the museum, just so you, I have to let you know, the museum is actually closed right now.
Oh, good. Thank you for telling me that. Okay, good.
Yeah, I don't want you coming banging on the door, but, and also because of the COVID restrictions,
we
are actually showing, the work is going to be in the walled garden.
Oh, lovely.
So, so you can see it without entering a building. The crew here at Strokestown are amazing. John O'Driscoll, Emma O'Toole, and the Irish Heritage Trust, they've been working so hard, and they've just reopened yesterday to the public, and the gardens here are beautiful. So I highly recommend a lovely day out, come down to Roscommon, bring a picnic, bring your wellies and your raincoat just in case. But it's an amazing place to be, and hopefully later in the summer, when hopefully restrictions lift, the big house itself will be open to guided tours. But regardless of that, you can experience my work in the walled garden, and then just really enjoy the place itself.
Artist Paula Stokes from the Ryan Tubridy Show. Now, school's out for summer if you're a secondary student, and Emma O'Kelly was talking to pupils finishing up after a very challenging year.
The sun is shining and transition year students are playing rounders in the yard of Our Lady of Mercy Secondary School when I arrive. This perfect scene belies the year these students have had. They've missed the normal things that TY should be all about. The class trips, the work experience, and on top of that, they had no junior cert exams last year. Here's TY students Libby Landers and Robin Rogers.
Online work was really hard because it wasn't interacting with teachers, it wasn't one-on-one. Like in school, you're allowed, if you have them, they come over, if you see them crossing the hall, it wasn't like that.
In TY, you look forward to a lot of the stuff such as trips and activities, and we had a trip organised for, I think it was before Christmas, to go to Glendalough, and that's sort of our bonding experience for the year, and that got cancelled obviously, so we didn't have one of them, and then we had obviously our 3 months off.
Well, the worst fears were, I suppose, that the students who were on the school completion targeted lists of being at risk of early school leaving, that they would not come back to us.
Pory Gibbons is principal at Our Lady of Mercy Secondary School. He says that thankfully those worst fears have not come to pass, but there's still danger ahead.
For a student who may come from a background with not a lot of support, or who may come from a difficult background, this is their safe place, essentially. And this is where they are free to express themselves and free to learn and to feel safe. We would have concerns in terms of how the current transition years, the current third years, and the current fifth years in particular will come back to us in September. There was a huge engagement in the online teaching. Every teacher did their best, every student did their best, but it is not the same. That needs to be recognised as a face-to-face teaching that could take place.
Back with the TYs, Ryan Merriman explains the challenge he faced during the school closures.
I just found it hard, like, being motivated to get up in the morning, like, online school. because when you're going to school, you're like, oh yeah, have to get dressed and go to school, but online, you can't really do any of that. And it's just the atmosphere at home isn't the same as in school as well, you know. You're trying to tell you, sit in your bed or just do nothing, you know.
Ryan's biggest concern is about the fact that he didn't get to sit his junior cert exams.
Like in Torja, everyone was like, thank God we didn't have the junior cert. But now looking at it, like I don't think any of us know where we are for education. So if someone said, you want to do the junior cert, I'd say yeah.
Classmates of Ryan's, like Kimberly Coker, nod assiduously as he expresses this concern.
Obviously, it's good that we didn't have to do it because there was no stress. But obviously, we don't know like what levels we're at.
Far away from Dublin 12 in the Laois countryside, another teenager is musing about the impact of the lockdowns on her education. Georgie Rome is in third year. It may seem odd, but she feels that during lockdown, her horizons actually expanded and she grew.
Through social media and stuff during lockdown, like you got to relate to a lot of people and what they were, their situations. There's the platform TikTok and like the Black Lives Matter protest, I think that was a big part of TikTok for a while.
You feel you've matured?
I have, yeah. Like I'd forgotten what it's like to do nothing and like not have training in the evening or have to finish my homework then just go to bed and wake up and do school all over again. I got to take time out and think.
So what lies ahead for the second level system's middle children, this year's junior cert and TY years? After the summer, there's some serious catching up to be done, as Pádraig Gibbons explains.
Third year is going into transition year. It will be much more of a structured academic approach. So the basics of your English, your Irish, your maths, your literacy, your numeracy, they can be caught up on to bridge that gap. In terms of transition year going into fifth year, again, there will be almost like a boot camp.
And what do Pádraig's students make of that?
Not good, no.
So going into fifth year now, you're going to have to put your head down. You're going to have to work really hard to get the grades that you want.
Emma O'Kelly's report from Morning Ireland. So how is Brexit impacting on the price of things from building materials to your new three-piece suite? Brian O'Connell was reporting in the morning.
We had a pretty long run-in into Brexit where businesses were preparing customers for the impact it was going to have. And I suppose already if you've ordered anything online from the UK over a certain price, you're going to be hit with additional charges. But then on top of that, obviously we add COVID. And what I've been hearing is that both of them combined are having a very significant impact on goods and services. And this is leading to huge uncertainty for buyers and for sellers, of course. It's been felt, Claire, across a wide range of businesses, goods and services, as I found out.
So let's talk first of all, Brian, about building and renovation costs, how they've been hit.
They've been hit very badly. I mean, there is an issue of shortage of workers, but I suppose the main issue here is the price of materials. Builders have been telling me everything from a plank of wood to a screw has risen in cost anywhere from 15 to 40%. I've actually just tweeted an email that a manufacturer got this morning from a timber supplier. And in 1 year, timber has tripled. In their case, chipboard has doubled. So the international supply lines, some of the reasons being given, the rise in demand, issues around shortages, even the recent Suez Canal crisis, they're all some of the reasons builders that I've been speaking to are being given for these significant price rises. We're going to hear from different industries shortly, but firstly, Claire, I want to take you onto a site on a finished renovation project by a company called Cork Attic Conversions, and they've renovated an old labourer's cottage in Cork City. Now, the volatility at present in terms of building material prices means if that company is to quote, for example, to renovate your attic or to put on an extension, they can only guarantee that quote now for a couple of weeks. This is Ger O'Brien from Cork Attic Conversions.
We're renovating a terraced cottage here in the north side. We got it, we started it before lockdown and we're finishing off now.
So it's a one bedroom former probably labourer's cottage?
Labourer's cottage, yeah. There was trees growing out of them when we came here. So now we've finished it off. It looks well.
So there's two things, there's COVID and there's Brexit, and obviously both of them are impacting on the building trade.
Well, I saw prices creep up last year, but this year they've significantly increased.
But how much do you reckon?
Oh, anywhere from 15 to 40% are the figures that I've heard, you know. Builder suppliers that I deal with, they give you a quote, they only stand over that quote.
for 3 weeks, and before that would have been.
Oh, there was no mention of a time limit on that.
So does that mean then, Ger, when you're pricing jobs, you can obviously only price jobs for a certain period of time?
Right, no, you can. Well, going forward, that's it.
And what are the reasons you're being given for these price increases?
COVID, Brexit. I've also heard that suppliers are stockpiling material, waiting for prices to go up, so the demand will go up. It's throughout the board, throughout, like from screws, steel, everything, right throughout, encompass the whole lot.
So if I was looking to convert my attic before, say for example, it might have cost me €40,000, now that's going to cost me...
I do it for 40 still.
But you're definitely looking at an increase in costs.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And have you been given any certainty from the builder suppliers as to when prices might stabilise?
None whatsoever, none. But if you're going to the client, then we're asking them to review it. Obviously, they're not going to be happy about it. If you're going to say, listen, there's going to be a price increase of 10 to 15%.
The COVID issue, we can understand. It obviously came upon us all quite quickly. But Brexit, we've had quite a while to prepare for it.
I think that they're hiding behind Brexit and COVID to increase the prices. Maybe that's pessimistic, but the bottom line is the prices are going up, and up considerably.
Ger O'Brien there, and Brian was also looking at furniture sales.
For example, a large supplier here might order your new three-piece suite, say in a container, and in that container they'd have many other items, and it was usually a set price. That price has skyrocketed, so you're likely to see a fairly significant rise then in the cost of your new furniture. Now, Peter Caffrey of Caffrey's Furniture and Interior Creations, he's been in business 40 years. He told me you could be looking at somewhere in the region of €500 added to a suite of furniture, given the increases in both transport and timber costs.
Just till last year, I would say a container was anchored between $2,500 to $3,000. And today, that container could be anchored between $10,000 to $11,000. You hear all sorts of excuses. I suppose last August, September, started going up and up, kept going up $1,000 every week. And then after Christmas, I suppose last February, started coming down. And then that Suez Canal thing happened, and it shot back up again. When a ship had landed in America, it used to be 4-day turnaround for the container to get emptied and get back on the ship. Now it's taken about 2 weeks to 3 weeks for that to happen. And that's happening all over the world. So we say chipboard has gone way up as well. Chipboard's gone up 20% from the 1st of January. And MDF we use, it's gone up about 20% as well.
So in theory, if I'm buying, let's say, for example, I'm buying a bed, I'm likely to be paying a lot more for it this year compared to last year.
You're going to be paying 20, 25% more for that, yeah.
So how do you project forward then in business, Peter? I mean, how do you...
We're all hoping that it's going to come down, but they tell me all the Christmas stuff starts coming in August. You know, the ties, all the containers. So there's going to be a shortage of containers. So they said it could be after the Chinese New Year before prices start coming down next year. Like, you know, the container prices will come down. They'll never come down to what they were, they tell me, shipping companies, but they'll come down to maybe more realistic 5,000 or something like that.
You're in business a long time, Peter. Have you noticed in the past that there have been times like this when logistics were an issue?
Never as bad as this, like, you know. But the problem is with timber now as well. I got on to the guy when he said it went up 30%. Listen, I want the same load as last month. I said, but I wanted at the old price. But he said, even at the new price, I can only give you half the timber that I gave you last month. There's a shortage on it.
Brian, I'm still that price increase on the suite of furniture of €500 and then 25% Peter mentioned on other items. I mean, it's significant. And then, of course, the worry is that COVID will end, hopefully. Brexit will bed in, but the price increases will remain.
I mean, that is the big concern, isn't it? Very hard to get building costs down, for example, once they've gone up, as anyone who's ever had any work done in your house will tell you. But I suppose one other area I wanted to look at, Claire, was bicycles. Hainelli Bikes, it's a family-owned business in Limerick. They specialise in manufacturing and refurbishing bicycles, many of them vintage. And they've been telling me of significant impacts Brexit is having on their ability to produce bicycles. Now, I spoke to Marty Mannering. He's from Hainelli Bikes. They also run a very interesting bicycle engineering academy where they train people how to repair and manufacture bicycles. He began by talking firstly about the huge rise in demand for bicycles.
The whole cycling world was caught by surprise. The people would want to just all get onto bikes, and there was nobody, including the manufacturers, ready for it because nobody expected it. So then within 6 months, everybody was starting to realize this. You know, the world had sort of copped on to the whole cycling thing as an initiative. Like, for example, you know, the specialist folding bike company in the UK, Brompton. And we would do about 100 of those a year. We're now doing 600 of those a year. And Brompton are now quartering the bikes they can give us rather than trying to sell us those bikes. because the factory, the Brompton factory, is one hand-built factory in London that employs 250 people. They've had to triple the workforce and they still can't keep up with worldwide demand. So nobody was expecting it, or otherwise we'd all be rich.
Demand is a huge factor. What about Brexit and what about COVID? I'm sure they're not helping.
Brexit, absolute 100% nightmare. Never experienced anything like it. Nobody expected it to be as bad as it has become. So impossible to deal with trying to bring things across the water.
Give me a practical example that I can relate to in terms of a bike.
Okay, so the UK company that we've always dealt with for 19 years for electric bicycles, a business called Whisper, they're a British electric bike. We've been dealing with it forever. We've now stopped doing it. Just 19 years of business, stopped. And the reason is the amount of customs regulation paperwork involved is too expensive to deal with. And then nobody, but absolutely nobody, can predict how much any of this is going to cost. Our electric tricycle, for example, it's a €2,500 tricycle with €2,000 added to it now because of customs. So you've pretty much doubled the cost and made it completely unpriceable.
Brian O'Connell's report from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, the increase in the cost of postage from Unpost, which was announced a month ago, and its impact on people sending parcels abroad.
I think when the Unpost announced the postage stamp increases about a month ago, I don't think many people heeded them, because mainly because the standing of Unpost in the country during the pandemic is incredible. They did incredibly well day in, day out, all over the country, not just delivering, but collecting from older people, not just delivering, but checking on older people, especially during the pandemic. They brought in free postage to nursing homes, an incredible gesture, which I think is still in existence. And the stamp went up by 10 cents to €1.10. But now other increases are coming into effect. So let's hear about them from people who've contacted us. Mary Lawless, good afternoon, Mary.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay, what will you tell us your story?
My story is I have my daughter Amy lives in just outside Christchurch in New Zealand.
Okay.
And I send her parcels, have been, she's there 11 years, so I send her parcels about 2, 3, 4 times a year, depending. Okay. And so the last parcel I sent her was in, I think, early April, and it was €71 for 8-9 kilos.
Okay.
And I was in the post office yesterday, and I usually check, used to be able to send 20 kilos any size box, but it couldn't be over 20 kilos.
It's the weight, yeah.
So usually when I'm in the post office, I ask the girl, is, you know, the post to New Zealand still the same? It was reduced to 10 kilos during the pandemic. And she said, oh, no, it's still only 10 kilos. But she said, you know, the post has gone up. And mm-hmm. I said, oh, really? And
well, it's gone up on the postage, on the letter, it's gone up 10%.
Yeah.
What's it gone up on the parcels?
So my 70-odd euro parcel has now gone up to €180.
Wow.
So, I mean, to me, it's double the price, more than double the
more
price.
More than double, yeah.
And it's just, you know, I was just heartbroken because I like to send the parcels. Amy loves to get them. It's a connection to home. I know I send her, like, all sorts of bits and pieces, you know, her crisps and tea bags and chocolate and decorate, you know, Easter or Halloween decorations, whatever it would be. But, yeah, I'm just so upset. I understand things have to go up, but why did they go up by that amount?
It's about 160%, I think.
Yeah. And
what's in the box?
Well, this is what would be in the box. I would send crisps, tea bags,
yeah,
chocolate.
Yeah, Tato,
she loves
Cadbury's chocolate.
Cadbury's chocolate.
Yeah.
You know, sort of biscuits, whatever her favourite biscuits are.
Yeah.
And just little things that recently I was sending her. I think, like, she's a promotion for Ireland because I was sending her the new curry sauce, chef curry sauce, and she was amazed at this because I have to say the chips in New Zealand are not the best. Like, I've been over a few times, and she had friends over, and they had fish and chips, and they were amazed at this new sauce.
Okay, the chef curry sauce. Okay, okay. So, but it came to less than 10 kilo.
Just less than 10 kilo, okay. Yeah.
And people, before people ring in or text in on 51551, wash your hands about you can get Cadbury's chocolate in New Zealand. There is no Cadbury's chocolate like Irish Cadbury's chocolate.
No.
Because Irish Cadbury's chocolate is made from Irish milk, an Irish chocolate crumb, which is milled down in Rathmore. I hope it still is down in West Cork, stroke Kerry, from Irish cattle. And there's no Cadbury's chocolate that tastes better than Irish Cadbury's chocolate because of the organic chocolate crumb that goes into it. It's an incredible brand.
Yeah.
So, and I know you can get a flake in Australia, but it doesn't taste like our flakes. But anyway, so what is the value of this, the contents of the parcel that will cost you €180 to send?
Yes, the value could be anything between 50 and maybe 70 euro, depending on, you know, if I'm, that's just kind of grocery things, but in the parcel I would put in clothes or birthday presents or whatever it would be.
Yeah.
Like for this past Christmas, I actually sent her four parcels at 70 odd euro each because you couldn't send the 20 kilo one. So as a family, we would put a parcel together and everybody would put in their little gifts for herself and her husband Andy and her little baby Maeve. And so, yeah, I never actually put it, you know, I don't sort of think of the value of it. It's just watching her. She sends me a video. The mom, look what arrived
today. There's nothing
nicer.
Remember, you remember back in the, well, we used to have, wait for this, Mary. We used to have relations that lived up in Port Rush in Northern Ireland, okay?
Yeah.
And they used to send us parcels. Mm-hmm. Of, you remember they used to have bars up the north like Spangles,
yeah,
that
yeah.
you couldn't, and caramel milk that you couldn't get down here. Now, when the parcel arrived, there were six children in their house. They'd be killing to get to open it, the excitement, and who'd get the. So it's the same, I presume, when they. I know they don't kill each other, but it's a great occasion when you get a parcel from home.
Then Hugh called about sending parcels to Texas.
Yeah, my daughter lives in Dallas, Aoife.
Okay.
And everybody calls her Aofi.
Aofi, okay. Aofi.
I normally send her over a package once a month recently, you know.
Yeah.
And it's worked out for 2 kilos, it's 20 euros. Now, I send her the usual stuff like jammy dodgers and chocolate bars and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Things, tea bags that you can't get here. So the last three times that I sent it was 20 euros. Now, it's 9 euros for the box, which you have to buy from on post, which is quite expensive anyway for the box.
Hmm.
But and then it was 11 euros for the postage on top of that. So I went in yesterday, and I said to the girl, I want to send this to my daughter in Texas. And she said, well, the post has gone up. And I says, how much? And she said, well, a letter was $1.70 to the US, and now it's gone up to $2. So I said, well, that's about 15%. I said, that's reasonable.
€2, yeah, yeah.
So when I went, she weighed the package, and I said, what's the oil? She said, that's 28 euros altogether. And I said, gee, that's very high increase. That's about 75% increase on what I previously paid. And I sent stuff over to my grandson. I haven't seen him yet. He's 13 months old. He lives over there in Texas. And I sent him over. He likes white chocolate, which you can't get over there. The white Nestle white buttons, you know, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he loves all that. And now I see him. He recognizes me. I see him on...
Okay.
And he's starting to walk and talk and look at people. I haven't seen him yet, and she's coming home in August, and I'm looking forward to seeing her. But she loves these little things that she can't get here, and it's getting to the stage where you're wondering, is it too expensive to send the things over? You know, nobody minds an increase. Everybody has to eat and live, but the 75% of an increase, I just can't see how it can be justified.
Well, that's Hugh. Then Mary called about her son in Vancouver.
He went to Vancouver just at the start of the pandemic last year, end of February. And obviously we couldn't get over to see him, so I was checking out how to send stuff to him.
Right.
And I came across this company. It's located in Ballymun. I just looked it up there. It's called Paddy Box.
Okay.
And I've sent him a number of boxes from them now, and it's an Irish company trying to keep in touch with people around the world, and they have crisps and tea bags. But, you know, you can choose.
Okay.
It's like a hamper, so you pick which box you want.
Yeah, but you don't put the socks or the jocks from Penny's in.
You don't. No, you do.
It's a prepacked box.
It's a pre-packed box, and it's mostly food and birthday cards.
And
or,
you see, your son in Vancouver, I know Vancouver, I think, was voted the happiest place in the world to live because of the beautiful summers and skiing winters and all the kind of very nice people. Well,
oh
your
my God,
son,
the quality of life is fantastic over there.
But Mary, he's never tasted chef curry sauce, has he? Is there chef curry sauce in that paddy box?
Do you know, I think there is, Joe. I'm just looking at it online now.
Oh, okay.
there's spice bag.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, there's McDonald's original curry sauce, Bisto, Dib Dabs, Toffee Pops.
Why am I so hungry? That's Mary on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Ryan was very keen to talk to Elena Ryan, the CEO of Children's Books Ireland.
The reason I wanted to talk to you was when people put their hands in their pocket when they're watching The Late Late Show, whether it's the toy show, which raised over 6.5 million, or the whole season plus a bit, which raised 20 million, I really wanted to tell them how important that their donations were and are. And it's not always easy to explain it to people. But when I saw the clip of a school and the books going into children's hands, I thought this is a physical realization of a donation into practical books into children's hands, and therefore investing into the future of our children who will be reading and imagining and learning. So can you tell me what the connection is between children's books, the toy show, and people listening in who donated? That's my question.
Yes, absolutely. I'd be very happy to. So we have... Well, frankly, this year we heard from about 400 schools who wanted school libraries.
Okay.
They all applied to us. They all said, we don't have books, or we don't have enough books, or we don't have books where the characters look like the kids in our classroom.
Great.
Or our books are falling apart because there hasn't been funding for school libraries since 2009. So schools are struggling. Wow. And we heard this for a long time and wanted to do something about it. So we have selected four schools that we're going to work with. And the people of Ireland have funded this through the Late Late Toy Show. These four schools are going to get 1,000 books each. We're going to work with them over 3 years. And each of them is going to be given an artist, an author or illustrator to work with them over those 3 years.
Wow.
They'll get about a day a month with this artist. So they're going to be working with the whole school to build a love of reading and build a buzz around reading and put fresh books in there that are rich and diverse and that cater to readers who have difficulties. And it's going to be such an exciting project.
Give me that figure about 2009 again. What hasn't happened since 2009?
There was a government grant that came through the Department of Education, the school library grant, and it was about €4.50 a head per child, and it was cut entirely in the recession. So budget 2008, they decided from 2009 this grant is gone, 100%.
And never reinstated again?
Never reinstated, no. So there is no funding for books in schools outside of textbooks.
That is breathtaking in its stupidity. A lack of foresight in terms of the next generation, insight in terms to the current generation, and any sight at all. It's blind stupidity.
Elena Ryan of Children's Books Ireland from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.